We're coming off a confirmation earlier in this presidency, but a block at the end of the Obama presidency. And I think a lot of people wonder, well, the Democrats are now saying, well, we can hold this like you did the last time with the last nominee. There is precedent for some of this manipulation that you've written about in your book.
Well, there's definitely precedent for the minority in the Senate or even a majority in the Senate that opposes a president to take temperature on the president's political strength, note that that strength is not there, and react accordingly. You know, if you go back to the 19th century, John Tyler, one of the weakest presidents in history, never elected, obviously. Andrew Johnson, who took over from Lincoln after his assassination. These were very weak presidents. Johnson was impeached. You can't get much weaker than that. And yet, their Supreme Court nominees, whether or not they were qualified, were going to be attacked, and they were attacked. It didn't really matter whether they were qualified. The president who was nominating them did not have much political power to fight back. And that's really what we saw with Barack Obama 2 years ago at this point. And what we're seeing now is when you do have the political strength on your side in the form of a Senate that agrees with you, anything is possible. We will see a fight, but it's hard to imagine the Republicans not getting their man.
You have written previously about the various factors that shape the recruitment of someone to the Supreme Court, but as in many cases right now, all of the norms that we expect kind of out the window.
Well, the biggest norm was the need for some bipartisan consensus, that you would need at least 8 to 10 from the other side, or there would be either a filibuster or it would be a nail-biter. Now, there were exceptions. Clarence Thomas, you know, got through 52 to 48, but there were a handful of Democrats that made it possible. With the filibuster now gone, you can get the person through on the basis of a strict party line. That's probably what's going to happen. And so that means that you can appoint a very, very conservative nominee, as Justice Gorsuch was, as Judge Kavanaugh, soon to be Justice Kavanaugh, might be. And there's almost nothing that the minority can do to stop it. So that norm of bipartisan consensus, I think I mentioned in the book the importance of ABA qualifications. Those kinds of things are almost irrelevant now.
President Trump has decided to use another standard, not the Bar Association, which was basically the conservative organization list that he received, and that's who he's been working with.
Yeah, you know, the Federalist Society has always had a tremendous interest in getting extremely conservative judges on the bench. The truth is, Republican presidents in the modern era have listened and taken advice from interest groups like the Federalist Society, the Cato Institute, the American Heritage. Of course, what's so unusual now is that President Trump openly is saying they're going to be vetting my nominees, they're providing the list, and I'm consulting with them, and he doesn't make any buts about it. And that willingness to be so open about it is very unusual and highly unprecedented.
At the same time, one of the issues that always comes up with Supreme Court nominations, especially in the time of that you studied very closely, when you had the advantage of all the internal memos and the discussions, which we don't have, because when you finished your book, that's when the clamp was put down on access to presidential papers. Linda Greenhouse's piece recently in the New York Times about the so-called Ginsburg rule, where the justice candidate would not be talking about their positions. Just within the last 24 hours since we sat down to do this, one of the senators said there's a million pages of Kavanaugh's writings to look through, which, of course, the Senate leadership is saying, well, we're not going to have time to go through all of that. This documented opinion from lower court rulings and previous writings seems to be where the focus is.
Well, absolutely. If you didn't have the end of the filibuster rule, and if you didn't have one of the most polarized Senates and Congresses in history, the fact that Judge Kavanaugh was working in the White House at critical times in history, was working with Ken Starr on the investigation of Bill Clinton, was working hard for the Bush campaign during Bush versus Gore. All of this is going to create mounds of paper. And somewhere in there, these papers, you and I both know, something embarrassing, something unfortunate was said. This could all be a tremendous headache. And so you would have probably had people advising heavily against a Kavanaugh nomination, because he wouldn't be the stealth nominee that a David Souter or others were. better to have somebody that there isn't much paper. Well, again, Judge Kavanaugh is probably going to be confirmed despite that because you have a polarized Senate and the Republican numbers are there.
You've always described this as a political process because obviously we're talking about presidential politics. In your book, you do cite that like the situation when Obama made his nomination of Merrick Garland and was told by Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, that we're just not going to move on this because we need the next president to do this, even though the sitting president has the constitutional right to make a nomination. This has happened several times, as you
well,
say.
Well, I think what Mitch McConnell is arguing is if a president is in his final year, and everybody agrees it's his final year, he's truly a lame duck, that we don't allow these things through. Now, the truth is we may not have had presidents in final years, although Lyndon Johnson was certainly in his final year when he nominated Abe Fortas to be Chief Justice. But there's a long history of presidents nominating justices in presidential election years. They've gotten hearings. They've gotten discussion. They've gotten floor votes. What's so unusual here is the declaration that this time we're going to let the American people decide. The Democrat response is a pretty good one. The American people did decide twice by electing Barack Obama to 8-year terms. They didn't elect him to a 3-year term in 2012. So does the last year not count? But when you have the votes, you don't have to listen to that kind of logic.
Is there any sense that we can go back to where it was a little bit more civil and a little bit different in the way we approach things? Or is it this, as many critics and talking heads are thinking, is just blowing everything out of the water and we may be passing a mark that we can't return to?
The short answer is we cannot return in kind of a slow incremental way. The last time the Congress was this polarized was the 1850s. And in the 1860s, we had a civil war. And then, of course, that blew up the party system as we knew it then. The birth of the Republican Party in the 1850s was a response to just how polarized things had gotten. God forbid we have another civil war, but something like that, maybe a faux civil war or a cold civil war, is going to be required to shake up the political system to the point where the two parties are not this polarized. It is an incredibly tribal situation. Friends, neighbors, it's hard for them to talk across party lines anymore, and certainly the Senate and the House is representative of that sentiment.
Again, one of the things that you've talked about previously, and as I referenced it, you did this your book initially just before access to presidential papers pretty much disappeared.
We'll say declined heavily. We'll say George W. Bush decided that almost everything was a national security threat.
But you also point out that in certain presidencies, like Kennedy's and others, there wasn't a lot of on-the-record discussion about this. It was more conversational, which is certainly how this president seems to be functioning. Looking ahead, for scholars such as yourself and those that are interested in this subject matter, how difficult is it going to be to try and determine how you can analyze this process going forward?
Well, it's going to be hard to determine who said what to Donald Trump when. I don't think any of us believe that once Donald Trump is done being president, he's going to have such a great memory for everything he said. There's probably going to be a lot of disagreement about what he said. Here's what I will say. The gold mine for historians in 10 or 20 years from now, when they look back on the Trump selection process, is going to be walking over to the Federalist Society offices and asking to look at their documents and asking to look at their papers. And those aren't covered by the Presidential Records Act. I think that what enterprising scholars are going to have to do is throw away the old playbook and find new ways to get this information. The old rules just don't apply anymore. They don't apply in the decision making, and I'm not sure they're going to apply in scholarship either.
Professor David Yellow, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure, Ken, as always.